morning. This is Hugh LaFollette, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with author Richard Russo about his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Empire Falls. Richard, glad to have you on the show.
Well, it's nice to be here.
I realize you don't want to give the entire story away, but I think for those who've not read the book, maybe you can give the listener a 2-3-4 minute snapshot of at least some of the major themes in the book as you understand them.
Sure. Well, in a way, the book is large in its scope. It follows three generations of two different families in the town of Empire Falls, Maine. There is the Whiting family, which has pretty much owned the town back through several generations, and who's the last living member of which, Francine Whiting, as the story opens, owns what little is left of the town that is worth owning. The other family that this concerns is the Roby family. Miles is the proprietor of the Empire Grill, which is owned by Mrs. Whiting, and it is the story of his family and his daughter Tick, and also his mother, who has from the past generation, who has died before the novel opens, but plays a very significant role in it anyway. So that's the larger sense of the story, kind of a sprawling book about three generations of two families at the upper end of the economic spectrum and at the lower end of the economic spectrum. In another way, it's a much smaller book than that, because this is a father, at its heart, I think this is a father-daughter story, the story of Miles Roby's attempts to create or to in some way ensure a future for his beloved daughter Tick that will be less so that she will be less circumscribed by necessity than he has been.
Okay, that's I think it's very helpful. One of the things too that I noticed upon reading the book, and I wonder if you could comment on, is that when you look at the characters, Miles certainly the most, but also all the other major characters, you see that their sense of themselves, of their place in the town, their place in the world, their understanding of other people, changes, evolves, emerges over time in ways that are both very important to understanding them and also very important to understanding the story.
Right.
Would you like to talk about that just a bit, the sense and the way in which people's self-understanding and the character's self-understanding and understanding of others does unfold?
That's interesting that you bring that up, because I was just in a cab. I'm in New York as we're speaking now, but I was in a cab talking with a couple of other authors as we were heading down to an event, and the subject that they brought up was amnesia stories. And one of the other authors was saying that in a sense all good stories are amnesia stories, in the sense that the books that we feel most engaged by very often are books about someone who may have lost some sort of sense of who they are at the beginning of the story, but by the end of the story have discovered something about themselves and who they were and who they are and what their lives are going to be like from that point forward. And you think of Dickensian stories like Oliver Twist, who starts out starts out an orphan, which of course immediately asks that question of who are you, where did you come from, what could your future be like, until you begin to understand who you are. I think most really good novels involve some sort of discovery of the self. And this particular novel, I think, is engaging in that level, because a lot of the characters, as the novel opens, are none too sure who they are. And that's true of all of the generations. C.B. Whiting, at the very beginning of the novel, is the man who sets everything in motion. He has this notion of himself as a young man, as someone who's going to grow up to be a poet. He wants no part of his father's empire in Empire Falls. He doesn't want to be the owner of the shirt factory, the operator of the paper factory. He doesn't want to oversee the textile mill, all of these things that his destiny would seem to suggest that he's going to do. He thinks of himself as in his truest destiny, perhaps a poet or a painter, and not living in Empire Falls, rather, but in somebody, but somewhere warm. And as the novel opens, he's living down in Mexico, and he gets the call from his father to return to Empire Falls and begin to take over the empire. So here's the first character that we see in the book is somebody who has a very different sense of himself and of his destiny than before events begin to intervene and decide things for him. The main character, Miles Roby, as the novel opens, is in a similar situation. He's in his mid-40s. When he was a young man, he went away to college, as his mother was his mother's dream for him to do, and he is within just a couple months of graduating from the university when his mother falls ill and circumstances require him to return to Empire Falls to take over the Mrs. Whiting's failing diner. And as the novel opens, he's in his early 40s and suddenly realizes here he is in Empire Falls living an entirely different life than he ever imagined that he was going to live, and trying to come to terms with the various, you know, curves that life has thrown him. And discovering, of course, that now his beloved daughter is right on the cusp of those kinds of dilemmas for herself. She's a sophomore in high school. He's already very concerned about what kind of life she is going to have, and is very afraid that if he's not careful, she is going to be the next proprietor of the Empire Grill, something that he is absolutely determined will not happen.
Okay, so part of what happens is there's both an evolving sense of who they are, and part of what changes that evolving sense of who they are is the circumstances change.
Sure. And not only circumstances, too, but it's not just that things are done to them, but as a result of those things, they've made choices. They've made choices, and every other, whenever I used to tell my students when you're plotting a novel that at the beginning, in a novel, you can walk through, say, one of 50 doors. But once you walk past one of those doors, the door closes behind you. You now have fewer options. Where you had 50 doors to choose from before, once you walk through, now you have 10 doors to choose from. And when you walk through that door, you have 4 doors to choose from. And then suddenly you have 1 door to choose from, and then you're 42 years old, and you have no more choices. That's the situation that Miles finds himself in.
Yeah. Well, I may just get a bit off, but I would also say that sometimes when you go through the doors, you discover that they're new doors you didn't see before.
That's a possibility as well.
Yeah. I wonder, too, one of the reasons why this device seems to me to be very effective in this story is that it's the way we come to understand ourselves and other people. It's not that you've created science fiction here. You've created fiction. You've created fictional characters who do the very sorts of things that we do when we think about understanding ourselves, understanding our other people, understanding our aspirations, that those things unfold over time.
Yeah, and this is a book that's very much about time. It's a big book in that sense because it has the three generations in it, but it's also about the passage of time and what time does to human beings, and the way in which people of one time have an almost ghost-like effect on people who are going to come after them. In a sense, this is a story about the way dreams get passed along. Grace's dream for Miles getting passed along to Miles, and then Miles passing it along to Tick, And so you get to see these various dreams and plans get worked out over a pretty long period of time in this book, compared to a lot of contemporary novels. We see a lot of novels these days that are the time frame may be, you know, a couple of months or a year. It's that kind of snapshot that catches a character in the middle of something. This book goes takes in a lot more time than that, and in that sense becomes about time and what time does.
In fact, you have a little monologue that Tick has to herself at one point, that these changes occur very slowly.
Right.
And that you'd think, she says to herself, that because they occur slowly, we'd have a better chance to prepare ourselves for them. But the fact is, we don't.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of my favorite. Thank you so much for pointing that passage out. It's one of my favorites in the novel, where Tick is in a kind of reverie and seeing something happen, something coming toward her in a kind of slow motion, and she's a very philosophical young 15-year-old, and that's what she's trying to decide as the chapter opens. Do things happen fast, or do they happen slow? And she comes to the conclusion, the correct conclusion, I think, is that for the most part, things happen slow. But no matter how slow they happen, we're never ready for them.
Right. In fact, I want to say, I think the character of Tick is absolutely spectacular. One of the most interesting adolescent characters I've ever seen in a novel.
She's one of my favorite characters in all of my novels.
Okay, good. Well, now, let me ask you a question, too, which I think is related to this, and has to do with a novelist's device, that some of what happens in the story is simply a recounting of events. Somebody did this, someone stood up, someone fell down, somebody hit someone right. left someone.
Right.
And some of what goes on in the novel, though not very much in this one, is at least a role for the narrator, who simply steps back, and the narrator, I assume, steps back and gives this God's eye picture of what's going on.
Right.
But the third thing that happens, and in some novels it plays a very large role, is you see inside people's minds, if you will. You see their introspections.
Right.
And I found myself thinking at the end of the book that there are only three people for whom that happens a great deal, and that's the Robys: Miles, Janine, and Tick.
Right.
And as I thought back, it happens in the flashbacks to C.B. Whiting a bit, and mm-hmm. it seemed to me it happened to the principal, Otto Meyer Jr. But other than that, I found myself thinking that you never see inside anyone else's mind, if you will. You simply see their behavior as recounted by one of the three characters.
Right.
Is that a conscious choice of a writer to let you see inside somebody in some cases and not in others?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's more of an unconscious decision, actually, to have a sense of what you need. There are a fair number of characters in here that we see inside their minds at least a little bit. There's even Jimmy Minty. There's one chapter in here where a minor character who's a policeman in the story. We get a flashback of the one time that he has left Empire Falls and gone to visit the University of Maine at Orono, a particularly bawdy chapter that I won't recount here for your readers. But I was temporarily in the character's mind, and I guess I was there because it seemed to me that was the only way I was going to be able to get at Jimmy Minty's fundamental humanity, his soul, as it were, because he was a character that was pretty easy to dislike in terms of what he said and what he did. But I wanted to, at least for a moment, get inside of him and see if I could reveal to readers why he was the way he was at this time in his life. Another much more important character, however, the character of Mrs. Whiting, Francine, we never go inside her mind at all. And I think that the reason for this, as I think about it now, I'm making it conscious, I'm explaining it, but I suspect at the time it was more unconscious, is that she, in the final, one of the final scenes in the novel, is perfectly understandable in terms of what she does and what she says. We don't really need to go into her mind, and so we don't. There's one of the climactic scenes in the novel Miles says to her, this is all about Mom and your husband, isn't it? He loved her and not you. That's what all of this has been about. This is why you've been tormenting me as you have. This is all revenge, isn't it? And she says, well, of course, dear boy. As if to suggest, well, you know, glad you finally figured that out. I've only been waiting, you know, 20 years or 30 years for you to figure that out. But then she goes on to say after that, when she turns to walk away, suddenly she stops and she turns back to him and says, but I hope you don't think that this means that I'm not fond of you. And in that line of dialogue, her admission that this whole, everything that she has done has been motivated by revenge, but it's revenge on a person that she's really quite fond of. My feeling was that my understanding and of her and the reader's understanding of her, what her life must have been like for all these years and why she's done what she's done, that her motivation is so clear through her dialogue and through her behavior that there was really no... there was nothing to be gained by being inside her mind. She's perfectly revealed without it. So I think the rule of thumb is that if you can reveal everything you need to reveal about a character without going into their minds, then stay out.
All right. Now that you say that, though, I wonder, does that imply that if you see inside their minds, you in fact do know more, understand more than if you don't? And if so, why is that? I mean, here's part of the reason I ask it, mm-hmm. even in terms of the characters, is that you look inside Janine's mind, for example, Miles' ex-wife,
right.
And yet you get the sense that she doesn't, at least through a large part of the novel, doesn't have a clue what's going on. Or at least I get the sense that she doesn't have much of a clue what's going on. That other people, for instance, her mother, have a better sense in some way of who she is, who the daughter is, who Janine is, than Janine does.
Oh, yes.
That being inside Janine's mind doesn't help in this case, at least when it comes to self-understanding.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't help her. It helps us.
Oh, okay.
You know, that's the distinction that I would make there. As a matter of fact, there are several characters in this novel, including Miles, the main character, who doesn't understand himself, for instance, nearly as well as Mrs. Whiting understands him. Janine, as you correctly point out, doesn't even begin to understand herself and what she's about nearly as well as her mother does, who tells her exactly. I mean, Janine, in a way, is a lot like Max, Miles' father. These are two characters who are so busy just being themselves that they have no need for, no desire to reflect on what things might be like for somebody else. They're both
okay.
Pretty well self-contained.
So the reader gets a better sense of who they are in part by understanding that they don't know who they are.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons I think this is a really interesting question has to do not only with understanding the characters and how you write the characters, but also how people read and understand the novel. I mean, one of the things I did is after I had read the book and thought about some of the questions that I might want to ask, I decided I'd go back and read a series of reviews of the book.
Uh-huh.
And one of the first ones I came across talks about Max as being a man of a complete desperation and a sad sack. And when I read that, I thought, gee, that just doesn't really fit my understanding of Max. Yeah, okay, there's a sense in which he is powerless, but sad sack and a man of desperation seem far too strong to me. Now, I'm not asking you to take sides, but I think it's indicative of the problem that we have in trying to read the novel, but also trying to understand other people, that two people can look at the same events, read the same words, see the same action, and come up with very different accounts.
Yeah, yeah.
Of what's going on in that case.
That's true. That very fact has come home to me in this book tour that I've been on, and also in reading the reviews. Very often, Miles is referred to in reviews and has been referred to by my readers as a loser. He doesn't strike me as a loser at all.
Nor me.
You know,
okay.
I'm quite. I mean, to my mind, he's heroic. I think, and heroic in this day and age, it seems to me, you can be heroic just by being a grown-up, you know, in this age of infantilizing everything. I mean, Miles is a genuine grown-up. He's clear-sighted. He sees what the hand that he has been dealt, and he goes about living his life under those circumstances with a kind of quiet dignity and courage that I find very endearing. I find the fact that he continues to climb that ladder to paint St. Catherine's Church, even though he knows that he is terrified of heights and will not be able to go up that ladder past a certain point, the fact that he continues to climb that ladder in order to do something that he loves and wants to do, even knowing what the event, what the likely result will be, strikes me as just very noble. And that's the way he goes about everything in his life. The fact that he doesn't have, you know, a lot of what people would call conventional success, I guess, doesn't make him a loser, at least in my eyes.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought he was a loser either. I would have thought maybe there was a bit of lack of self-confidence in Max. And certainly, I see this as a strength and not a flaw.
In Miles, he's, you mean? Not,
yes, in Miles.
Max has
right.
plenty of self-confidence.
Oh, okay. Right. that Miles is also, how do I want to say this? He cares a lot, in the case of Miles, he cares a lot about other people, and that sometimes makes people think of him as a sad sack.
Well, I mean, he's hamstrung by his affection. I think the thing about Miles is that he has, his gift from his mother, I think, is a great moral imagination. He's able to imagine what things are like from other people's points of view, and that makes it rather difficult for him to be selfish. He can't always move forward in a way that would be best for him, because he's always busy seeing things not just from his own point of view, but from other people's point of view as well, which is the main difference between him and his father, Max, who always manages to get whatever it is that he's after. As soon as he figures out what he wants, he's got a plan to get it, whether it's the $10 that's in the glove box of his son's car, or whether it's a way to get down to Florida to avoid the Maine winter, or whatever it is. He's not a man of great schemes to have great or monumental successes in life, but whatever it is that he has in mind to get or do, he just immediately finds a plan in order to achieve it. Miles, on the other hand, is constantly bogged down by every time he comes close to figuring out what he might want, he starts thinking about, well, what will that mean for Tick? What will that mean for Janine? What will that mean for my brother David? What will it mean to Mrs. Whiting if I decide to bail out on the Empire Grill and start looking at possibly buying a bookstore on Martha's Vineyard? He's constantly hamstrung by his decency, I think, as much as anything else.
Yeah, though that may not be a flaw.
No,
again, at all.
No.
Now let me ask you to amplify one thing that you talked about earlier. And again, it does seem to me it's a theme that comes through this book incredibly well, and that's the way in which the actions of previous generations or dreams of previous generations can influence later generations. I mean, it comes out in the three main characters, or the two main families, the three generations, the two main families you mentioned. But even Jimmy Minty, you see three generations.
Right.
And you see the same sort of thing happening there, albeit in a much smaller scale.
Right.
Is that meant to indicate something pretty profound about human nature?
Well, I don't know if it's profound. I find it very interesting. There's an almost political level to that observation, and then there's the very personal level of that observation in the kind of, you know, political and economic sense this story gets motivated by what economists like to think of as the third or fourth generation curse that happens when people build companies. The patriarch comes in with nothing, builds a company by the sweat of his own labors and forges something that will hopefully last. And then the son comes in and takes over. And sometimes the son will take that success and the father's dream of success and actually embellish it, and sometimes make it even more successful as a result of buying into the dream. By the third generation, very often that dream has become diluted or replaced by another dream, so that the third generation, and actually it's a little bit farther down the line than that in the case of the Whitings, but by the time we get to Charles Beaumont Whiting in the beginning of this novel, he's the one who has begun to substitute another dream, but he's also the one who has become the first absentee landlord of the company. He's the man who decides that it would be a good idea not to live among the very people who are responsible for his wealth, but rather to build a hacienda on the other side of the river and to keep the river between him and them. He is the personal working out of that kind of political and economic force that we see in companies played out time and time again. Just in personal ways, what happens between Grace, who has a dream that gets passed on to Miles, and who has a dream that will now be passed on to Tick. We see that I think happening in the real world all the time. I myself am an example of that. My grandfather was on my mother's side. My grandfather was a glove cutter, and I remember him from when I was growing up. Recently as a grown man, but having some sort of notion of it as a child, that here was a man who was misplaced. He was a glove cutter, a leather worker, but if he'd had any kind of opportunity at all, what he would have been is a teacher. He had a very inquiring mind. He was a natural communicator. He had an intellect that was pretty much wasted doing the work that he was doing, and that's what he should have been. That's what he should have done. Utterly unable to do it, he passed that dream along to my mother, who did a couple of years in college, and then met and married my father, and then passed that dream of being some sort of a teacher or a professor or a writer or something like that on to me. And I'm the kind of the third generation in which that dream has come to some sort of fruition, and we feel the weight of those dreams as Miles does and as Tick will in this book of dreams deferred. That's a famous Langston Hughes line, isn't it? What happens to a dream deferred?
All right, we're almost out of time. Maybe like at least briefly mention the book of short stories that's coming out.
Yeah. I mean, I've got about a month actually to just kind of catch my breath and go home and catch up on what I would otherwise call my life. But I have a book of short stories coming out. It's my first book of stories, actually. I've been writing stories for a long time, but I don't write them often or well, and it's taken me the better part of a little more than a decade to put together a half dozen or so short stories and a novella. To make a very slender, very un-Russo-like volume to stick on the shelf next to all of these fat novels that I write.
Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
Thank you, Hugh.
I've been speaking today with Richard Russo, author of Empire Falls. This is Ideas and Issues. Good day.